From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. May Martinez, have a good Monday to you. Now, I know if you've been outside today, you know it's a little bit hot. It's also a bit dry as well. And that combination often leads to fires, just like the one that started this morning right around 10:40 in the a.m. in the Pacific Palisades. Brush fire broke out in the 500 block of North Palisades Drive, has burned as many as 30 acres, this according to the Los Angeles Fire Department. Dozens of firefighters are currently on the scene. No structures have been lost, but there are several mandatory evacuation zones. On Charmel Lane to the west, Bienvenida Avenue to the east, Maryville Lane to the south, and at the end of Lackman Lane to the north. For all the latest details, we have L.A. Fire Department spokesperson Brian Humphrey. He joins us now from the scene. Brian, welcome to Take Two.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, real quick, what are the weather conditions right now where you are?
The weather conditions are good, but they're trending in a poor fashion. We were lucky today, maybe the first of 11 days, where we actually have had the fire danger de-escalate from the extreme level to what we consider a very high level. Not good news in a typical day, but a welcome change from what we had in the last few days. The sad thing is that we're moving towards a return to extreme and possibly red flag conditions on Thursday and Friday, and we're just starting to see that turn here about a mile and a half from the coast where this Palisades fire is now burning.
So it's getting a little windier?
A little bit of onshore. We're expecting it to trend to an offshore later, but any wind, of course, with the embers and a wildfire is of a concern.
Tell us about the terrain. From what I'm seeing on TV, it looks pretty rugged.
It is rugged, surprisingly rugged terrain, and one of the beauties of the Palisades area are the bluffs that overlook the ocean and the coast. And this, of course, is where wildfire thrives. The blaze, as you mentioned, broke out about 10:40 this morning, and the 800 block of Palisades Drive, just about 500 or 600 yards north of Sunset Boulevard, and moved up this canyon very quickly and threatened some homes in the area, the locations you earlier mentioned. We're pleased to report the most important number, far beyond acres or homes damaged, is the fact there have been no significant injuries and no loss of life. We did have one firefighter suffer exertion due to the extreme firefight and the terrain you described, billy goat territory, as some firefighters call it, with very rugged terrain.
How many firefighters right now on the scene?
More than 300 firefighters from the L.A. City and L.A. County Fire Department, and it's important to mention to your listeners that when it comes to wildfire in our region, local, regional, state, and federal agencies fight as one. In this case, the city and county working together by ground and by air.
How much interaction have the firefighters on the ground had with the fire? I'm mostly seeing helicopter and fixed wing drops.
The television coverage was remarkable and focused upon the drama of the intense flames, and those were at the head of the fire. And that's where helicopters, in particular, do their best work. And we had an armada of helicopters battling this fire from the city and county fire department, roughly 11 helicopters there, plus the helitankers. These are the bright orange, look like a dragonfly, the Ericsson air cranes, working their 18th year here in the city of Los Angeles. Those are amazing craft. And so those were dropping on the head of the fire. The firefighters themselves, with hand tools largely in this rough terrain, work the flanks of the fire. The idea is to put the helicopters to the head as the fire moves up the canyon to stop its forward progress, and then allow the firefighters to turn soil on the edge of this blaze, which has consumed roughly 30 acres.
You mentioned how it's getting a little bit breezier. How is the air quality, though, when it comes to people with health concerns?
Well, that's important. The smoke oftentimes causes a fire and problems in a structure fire, and a wildfire is no different. The smoke can be dangerous. While we're not aware of any inordinate hazard, many people in the area are suffering some ill effects, coughs and the like. So the mandatory evacuation order that's underway is a benefit not only to help firefighters maneuver through the neighborhood, but to get people out of harm's way.
And
those outside the mandatory evacuation area, we're asking them to shelter in place. To stay out of the smoky air.
As far as evacuation places where someone can go, Pacific Palisades Rec Center, is that the place right now where people can go if they want to evacuate?
That's correct. The Palisades Recreation Center, which is located at 851 Alma Rail Drive, has been open. And our friends at the Recreation and Parks Department have done a remarkable job working with Red Cross volunteers and others in helping open that center as a welcoming location that we hope to only have open for a few hours. The plan here on the fire attack, we're going to go very heavy at this fire until sunset this evening, and then we'll monitor the fire overnight to prevent its extension and hopefully have it out soon. Our hopes and desires are that these people will be back in their homes this evening if the danger has passed. Certainly, we'd like to get most of them back home.
That's Brian Humphrey from the LA Fire Department bringing us the latest on the Pacific Palisades brush fire. Brian, thanks a lot. right, moving on now to a topic we tackle often here on Take Two, and that's traffic. Specifically, we're looking at an idea to make some of LA's more popular thoroughfares car-free. Major cities have already toyed with the concept. Earlier this month, New York City banned private cars on one hectic street, turning it into a busway. And just last week, San Francisco officials approved a similar plan for popular Market Street. All that led Alyssa Walker to ask, what if we did it here in L.A.? Alyssa is the urbanism editor at Curbed. She's with us now in studio. Alyssa, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much.
So I should mention, it took New York City 3 years to roll out its pilot program, and now private cars are banned along 14th Street between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. For New York, what was the motivation behind their switch?
Well, at first, they thought they had to close their L train because of improvements that needed to be made, and then they decided that they needed to have a fast way to get people and buses and bikes over the area that was going to be closed. Then they realized they didn't have to close the L train after all, but they decided to still experiment with this very busy, as you said, very hectic street, and just see what would happen if they stopped not only cars from entering, but also the parking of cars, which takes up a lot of space, as you know.
Yeah. So, okay, I'm looking at the map. It's got some dedicated bus lanes, lots of room for people to walk around. How's it been working out for them?
Yeah, this has only been a few weeks, and everybody, I've seen it being called, you know, magical, right? So you've got buses moving faster than they were before. People are missing their stops because they're on time. They didn't expect them to be moving so quickly. People say the street is quieter, safer. They just feel safe being out on it. And then also, nothing has happened to the nearby street. So you'd think that the other streets would get clogged with traffic. That hasn't happened because bus ridership has gone up 15% on these buses.
Okay, so that leads us to your opinion piece in Curbed. It's titled Seven Los Angeles Streets That Should Go Car Free. And I really want to build a suspense. So before I ask you which streets you looked at, let's ask why. So why should LA consider banning private cars on certain streets?
Okay, so we've got three problems I think everyone can agree on. One is transportation emissions keep going up. We have a Green New Deal that is, you know, signed by the mayor. This is addressing that problem. We need to reduce our emissions, especially when it comes to private personal cars. Second of all, traffic congestion is worse. It's getting worse every year. If we can speed up some of those buses to get through that congestion, then people can get where they need to go faster. And the biggest other problem is that pedestrian deaths keep going up. Deaths overall, but pedestrian deaths specifically. So if we can make sure in a few different corridors we can prioritize these other modes, it could solve a lot of those problems.
All right. So let's get to these streets. The first one you target, and I think it's kind of obvious, but here, it's Hollywood Boulevard. So why Hollywood Boulevard?
Well, yeah, if you go to Hollywood Boulevard today, it is open. But over the next 14 days, I just looked this up, 10 days it will be closed for movie premieres, various events, right?
We're kind of used to it now, I guess, right?
Yeah, we know. So this one's a very obvious one. It's already closed a lot of the time. It's what we would call like a pedestrian magnet, right? It's got lots of people coming there from all over the place, people who aren't maybe familiar with how LA's streets work. So it would be a safer and better alternative to make sure we can get buses moving, let people on bikes and scooters get around, and just let everybody feel safe. They don't have to, you know, the sidewalks get so crowded. We don't want them walking on the street.
Yeah, it feels like Hollywood and Highland is closed all the time. You mentioned that. I mean, it just already feels like, I almost want to even throw it not even on the list and just make it already closed.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah, all right. So the next one on the corridor is the one that skirts MacArthur Park. Already a lot of pedestrians, and that's Alvarado Street. What makes it a particularly good candidate?
This is another very pedestrian-heavy street, but it's also one of the most transit-dependent places in the city. Car ownership is very low here. So let's look at these areas where people need transit to get around or are walking to get around and make sure that the buses can serve them. And then also, there's an amazing street vending culture here. There's so many people on the sidewalk selling stuff. Let's give them space and make this a true marketplace where we can, you know, enjoy what we buy and sell things and not have to worry about cars.
All right, let's look at one more, and that's Grand Avenue. What's Grand Avenue got?
So if you've waited in line to go to the Broad, you know that the sidewalks are very small and not very shaded. And there's lots of people going from MoCA to all the different museums. There's, you know, revitalized Grand Park, the music centers, there's all these different great places to go. And with the regional connector opening here in the next few years, so we'll have some of the best transit access in the county, really. So we really need to think about how we can get the cars off and make sure that people can get safely from one destination to another.
We're talking about closing some LA streets in the future, possibly, with a little Melissa Walker, urbanism editor at Curb. Now, you mentioned several more streets that you think are ripe for change: Broadway downtown, Santa Monica Boulevard through West Hollywood, Sunset, and Wilshire Boulevards. And we asked listeners for their thoughts on Facebook. One response came from Kay Foster, who said, quote, when you can get places without a car, make streets car free. But until then, we need cars. This town is too spread out. Alyssa, is that something that could make implementing car-free streets a little harder?
Well, I think that makes a really good case for reliable, dedicated busways that go through the city to make sure that
I knew you were going
to
say that.
To rely on a car to go far distances. But also, depending on where you are in LA, 30 to 50% of all trips are 3 miles or less. So if you think about that, especially like downtown, half of the trips are a bikeable or perhaps even walkable distance. So if we just make it easy to make those short trips without getting in a car, that could change the whole game when it comes to transportation in LA.
I'm going to add one more comment that no one here knows about. It's my uncle who moved here 50 years ago, you know, the promise of the car culture in LA. That's what kind of drew him to LA. And I told him about the story, and he says, well, you know, you close one street, then all of them are going to be closed. Do you think people might be worried, or have you got that reaction yet, that people might be worried that if you close some streets to car traffic, that eventually the entire city will be just one car-free place?
There is something that has been proposed and that our mayor has signed called the Fossil Fuel Streets Declaration, or Fossil Fuel Free Streets Declaration, right? And it does say that a major area of the city will be zero emission by 2030. So that means most of the way that people would be getting around in that area would be walking, biking, electric buses, yes, electric cars, but we have to really focus on, you know, the easy wins, which if you make streets safer for walking, biking, taking buses, people will move to those modes. We see it ourselves every time there's, say, a Ciclovia event, which is what opened up a lot of ideas and conversation about Hollywood Boulevard, because people want to get around on bus, on bike, and walking. We just need to make the conditions so to allow that.
Has this plan of yours, Alyssa, factored in possibly a future with driverless cars? Is that a possibility with what you're opining?
That is a possible solution that has not been proven yet to achieve a lot of the goals that I outlined at the beginning of the show, right? So yes, if they're electric, they would be zero emission. They might be able to help us cut back on traffic congestion, but we're not sure yet. And we're really iffy on the part about pedestrian safety when it comes to autonomous vehicles. So let's try to reduce car ownership first, then we can see if that can solve the problem.
Yeah, I don't think the technology exists yet for the car to avoid people quite yet, at least make it close to 100%.
Right.
Yeah. Now, you list out several reasons why you think LA could benefit from car-free streets. From what we saw in New York City, they may take a long time, though, to implement. Legal challenges, people were opposed. So I wonder if, just to close, if maybe you could paint a mental picture for us of what some of LA's more popular corridors might look like in, say, 5 to 10 years, if Alyssa, they all went car-free.
So it wouldn't have to be every street. Like I said, you know, your comment before was great, but it really doesn't need to
be. You left the door open, though, Alyssa. You left the door open.
It has to just be, we have to have networks. So if you think about, if you want to get from one place to another, is there a way that you might be able to bike the whole way there safely? If you wanted to get somewhere on a bus, would you be able to have, you know, good connections that are perhaps competitive in time with cars? So if just looking at a regular street, this is a regular LA street, you have probably, you know, 8 lanes of traffic in some case that are just designed for cars, and then maybe a little tiny bike lane and then a little tiny sidewalk. So we'd be reallocating a lot of that space to align more with our goals. The mayor's own goals wants to have 50% of walking, biking, and transit by 2035. That's not that far away. So we need to start thinking about how to redesign our streets to serve it. And we actually do have a plan for this network of bus lanes and bike lanes that, for whatever reason, you know, has not been a priority for the city. And now we're years behind. I mean, we're not behind cities like New York and San Francisco. We're behind cities like Denver and Indianapolis, who have these really wonderful options to help people get around their city. So I don't want to write the story again in a few years saying we have to, you know, beat Indianapolis to closing our streets.
It's because we were hardwired. The DNA of California, of LA, it's all, you know, was such, like I mentioned, a car culture kind of place. I think it's a little harder for us maybe to be free of that.
You can still have cars. They can just be electric cars, and we shouldn't force anyone to buy an electric car. So why not try to see if somebody would be more happy in an electric bike and use up less space on our streets?
One more quick thing, Alyssa. Has the city responded at all to your idea?
I have, you know, like I said, the mayor is now chair of this international climate group that is, you know, trying to reduce emissions. I have heard that after that Ciclovia in Hollywood, the council member is listening to thoughts about Hollywood specifically. So let's see.
All right. Alyssa Walker is the urbanism editor at Curbed. Alyssa, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. We're monitoring the brush fire in the Pacific Palisades. Broke out this morning. 30 acres have burned so far. An evacuation center has been set up at the Pacific Palisades Recreation Center. We'll keep you updated as more information comes in from the Los Angeles Fire Department. So stay right here with us. Let's turn now to higher education. College-level math is a big obstacle to graduation for many California students, and statistics is often the biggest roadblock with the math curriculum. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez dug around and found a decades-old effort to improve the teaching of statistics that's taking a new twist in Southern California.
Decades ago, Jessica Utz noticed there was something wrong with the teaching of statistics.
Both my mother and my sister had to take a statistics course for degrees that they were working on.
Her mother was a social worker who enrolled in a master's program. Her sister was starting college.
They had really opposite experiences. My mother had a wonderful experience because it was taught by someone who knew what that particular group of people needed. Whereas my sister had a horrible experience. It was taught as a formula-based course. Like it was a math course.
Utz went on to earn her doctorate in statistics and taught at UC Irvine. She put theory to practice 2 decades ago with her textbook, Seeing Through Statistics. The study of statistics helps students collect, interpret, and draw conclusions from data. It's useful in everything from predicting patterns of human behavior to creating algorithms to help you choose which movie to stream. Utz wondered if focusing introductory statistics classes on the concepts and showing how they apply to students before teaching formulas would improve the student experience. Her efforts are part of a movement to reform these classes. The approach is popular with instructors like Cal State LA psychology professor Ji Sun. She believes that in an increasingly information-rich world, students need to understand how to integrate data into their work and daily lives.
One of the things that I want my students to know is, how do you use facts? How do you use data? And how do you use it wisely? Because even if you have all the data in the world, you won't be guaranteed to be 100% correct.
Her introductory statistics course emphasizes group projects and discussion of statistical concepts, which are taught weeks before even the simplest formula is introduced.
Now, should I draw my standard deviation like this?
The new approach, Sun says, is the result of a decade of seeing students struggle with a topic.
Many of our students, even the students who got A's, understood very little.
How did you know that?
Because if you ask them any question that deviated a little bit in an important way, they would get it wrong. Their understanding seemed quite fragile.
Sun and Jim Stigler, a colleague from UCLA, took previous reforms a step further. They created a free online textbook with 1,200 questions. Stigler says the book's rollout last year generated mounds of data.
And then based on that data, we identify areas in the book where we think, oh, we can make that better. Or what? Why did everyone answer that question wrong? Oh, I think it's because that explanation we put right before it was not very clear.
Stigler says a better understanding of statistics is crucial in 2 ways. It prepares students for the growing number of jobs and data analysis, while society benefits when more people see nuance.
We want them to understand a little bit about what a probability is and what it means to say, I think it's, you know, probably an 80% probability that I'm right, but there's still a 20% chance that I'm wrong. You know, we believe the world will be a better place the more people who can think that way.
That's a noble idea, but it may take more than curriculum and adaptable text to get students there. Some students in Sun's class say they're struggling with the material, which raises the question, is this working? Stigler says early results suggest, yes, it is.
One of the things we do is after we've taught our course, on the final exam, we actually give students problems that they've never been taught how to solve.
And most students do well transferring what they learned to new problems. Stigler says he and son are beginning to work on a high school version of the class. Covering higher education, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Nicholas Meyer is most famous for resurrecting the Star Trek movie franchise after the disaster of Star Trek the Motion Picture. The Wrath of Khan, which he wrote and directed, is widely considered the best of the series, but Meyer wouldn't have been on Hollywood's map if, in the early 1970s, he hadn't written The 7% Solution, a surprise international bestseller that breathed new life into the Sherlock Holmes franchise. Meyer's newest book, The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols, puts Holmes and Watson on the tale of anti-Semites in Tsarist Russia, and here he is to tell us all about it.
My name is Nicholas Meyer. I was born at an early age in New York Hospital on Christmas Eve, 1945. World War II had been over about 15 minutes when I made my appearance.
The greatest, the wildest celebration of them all was in New York's Times Square. Never before or since has there been a crowd like this on the Great White Way.
I think when I was about 11, my father gave me the complete edition of all the Sherlock Holmes stories. And my recollection of this may be imperfect, but knowing me, I read the whole 60 stories at a gallop and a gulp.
I find it recorded in my notebook that it was a bleak and a windy day towards the end of March in the year 1892. Holmes had received a telegram where we sat at our lunch, and he scrolled a reply. He made no remark, but the matter remained in his thoughts, for he stood in front of the fire afterwards with a thoughtful face, smoking his pipe, and casting an occasional glance at the message. Suddenly, he turned upon me with a mischievous twinkle in his eyes.
I had never encountered anything like Sherlock Holmes before. And it deals with everything. In those 60 stories, it's like a lay Bible. You've got drug addiction and interracial marriage and the mafia and Mormons, and you've got failures because Holmes doesn't always succeed. So it seems very real, even if it isn't. Well, let's fast forward to 1971 when I came to Los Angeles to get into the movie business. But shortly after I'd begun to have some success writing television movies, the Writers Guild did something which they never do. They went on strike. And friends of mine who'd heard me babble on about my Holmes-Sigmund Freud cocaine idea said, well, now you have the perfect opportunity to write this book that you keep yammering about.
The 7% Solution by Nicholas Meyer. The discovery of an unpublished manuscript by John H. Watson may well engender in the world of letters as much skepticism as surprise.
And they were right.
Universal presents The 7% Solution, Nicholas Meyer's best-selling mystery from the personal memoirs of Dr. John H. Watson.
The 7% Solution became the number one best-selling novel in the United States for 40 weeks, and no one was more surprised than Mrs. Meyer's oldest. I wrote and or directed Star Trek 2, 4, and 6. That would be The Wrath of Khan, The Voyage Home, and The Undiscovered Country. Since then, I have intermittently been involved with the first year of Star Trek Discovery.
We're on a collision course with a pulsar.
Oh, what a relief. Thought we were all going to die.
When I was working on Star Trek The Undiscovered Country, it finally sort of the penny dropped in my head that Spock sometimes resembled Holmes. He is certainly the alien apostle of logic. So in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, he makes the rather cryptic remark,
An ancestor of mine maintained that if you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
And everywhere that the movie plays, Sherlock Holmes people jump up and down because he's obviously quoting Holmes, so Spock is some kind of, at least in theory, descendant of Holmes. So we fast forward to the latest effort here, which is called The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols, which was prompted more or less by Donald Trump and the era of fake news and forgeries. It's only a matter of time before you come across the worst and most successful forgery of all time, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion.
Protocol 12, Control of the Media. Protocol 13, Distractions. Protocol 14, Assault on Religion.
Which purports to be the minutes of a secret meeting of Jews bent on world domination. It's actually more complicated than that because it's actually plagiarized from something else entirely. So it's not even a real forgery, it's a fake forgery. You know, you say, set a thief to catch a thief. I thought, maybe since I'm a forger, I should go after a forger. So that's how the book came to be. The idea of the book is that Mycroft Holmes, the older brother of Sherlock, let's say he works for GCHQ or he works for the Secret Service, and Mycroft has come across this document about a Jewish plan for world domination. It doesn't look very plausible on the surface, but as part of the responsible member of government, they feel obliged to check it out. So Holmes is hired by Mycroft. So I'm going to read a little bit from The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols. This is an argument between Sherlock and his brother Mycroft over whether they should sort of drop this investigation into the protocols. Holmes doesn't think so, and Mycroft would really like it off his plate. "We need not pursue this," Mycroft said when we were again alone. "Because it involves Jews?" The detective's tone was scathing. Even in the dim light, I perceived Mycroft's flush, stung by the accusation. "That is unworthy of you, Sherlock. Some of my closest associates..." "Oh, to be sure," murmured the detective. "But for the record, this is not about Jews. You are one to talk," his brother shot back, "with your Jewish clients. Would I do better, in your view, to change my name from Sherlock to Shylock?" "Mycroft, listen to me. I entreat you. This is not about Jews. It is about truth, which we are bound to seek and to value. These protocols are almost certainly spurious news, but left unexposed, they will take root and grow in strength and credibility." I thought the protocols were a prime example of what we're dealing with today, which only seems to be getting worse with facial recognition, and you're suddenly substituting words coming out of other people's mouths. And how do we tell what's real? How does Sherlock tell what's real or not? It seemed that if anybody was going to be capable of taking it on, it was going to be him. It's odd to me that detective literature delivers precisely the opposite of what it promises. Murder most foul and things that go bump in the night, and the body was splayed at an unnatural angle with the head bashed in from blah, blah, blah. And people like to curl up with a good mystery. We take this stuff to bed with us. And I think it's a kind of comfort food, because what I probably discovered by age 11 is that real life makes no sense whatever. Bad things happen to people for no reason at all. But in detective stories, it's always happening for a reason, and Holmes is always there to sort of explain it in a civilized and rational way.
That was author Nicholas Meyer talking about his latest book, The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols. It's on sale right now, and that piece was produced by John Raby.